My name is Roger Bingham. I'm from originally from England, but I'm from California and the Salk Institute. But I run an organization called the Science Network, which is a kind of a public square for issues at the intersection of science and social policy. So it was with great delight that I listened to Ambassador Bokova saying that education, education, and education were important to her, and science was her priority. It reminded me of the new administration in the United States last year. The president himself said that he wished to restore science to its rightful place. And the Speaker of the House, a woman, Nancy Pelosi, said that if she was asked for her agenda, she would give it in four words: science, 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 and science. So, fortunately, we have a number of scientists here. With the earlier panel I did this morning was also dealing with science. This one is changing life as we know it. And I'm going to very quickly introduce the panelists. But first of all, let me just remind you how pertinent this is. These are just issues of current magazines that are out. The Economist talking about the power of mobile money and a special report on telecoms. You've already picked up a copy of Forbes Woman, which has the question on the front: who says women can't do math and science? There's a Discover magazine here called Growing a New You about stem cells. And I challenge you to look on the front page of any newspaper. And I think you'll find that most of the stories there, if you actually break them down, are science stories. They're about global warming, they're about the economy, they're about risk making, they're about healthcare, and so on. So that's the background upon which we're going to mount this discussion. The panelists are from this side: Maria Frere, who's director of Alaska Foundation, which is a major organization in the United States which funds medical research and also awards what is generally thought of as being America's Nobel Prize. So that when Ambassador Bokova just mentioned Liz Blackburn as having received a Nobel Prize, I'm glad to say that she's an external fellow at my institution, the Salk Institute, and she was also given a Lasker Award 3 years ago. So, Maria, you predicted that one very well. Next to her is Juan Enriquez, who is Managing Director of Excel Venture Management in the United States, but does much more than that, as we'll find out. Pat Churchland, who is perching in a yoga position, is a professor at UCSD in the philosophy department. Nita Farahani is another philosopher and lawyer from Vanderbilt University. She was on the earlier morning panel and has joined us for this one. Aubrey de Grey is the Chief Scientific Officer of SENS, which is Strategies for Engineering Negligible Senescence. He would like us to live much longer, and so would I. And finally, Cynthia Brazil, who is at the MIT and works on robots, brain-computer interface, personal robots, and so on and so forth. So why don't we start, Cynthia, with you? The very lovely poem that we listened to earlier had a line in it which is completely understandable, and it said it's the heart, it's not the brain, it's the heart. I understand what that means. That's about emotions and passions and so on. But I would submit to you that you're not going to get very far without a brain. You're making value decisions at this very moment. You're assessing things. You're doing computation online. Making value. So your brain is where all the ideas that Ambassador Bokova talked about are coming from. Your brain is being changed as we speak. And your brain is being changed by all the technologies that exist out there. Cynthia works in this area. Perhaps you'd like to sort of start us off by commenting on that.
Well, I work in robotics, so I don't know if you're going more the neuroscience angle. Maybe actually one of our other panelists might be more suited to it. Do you want me to speak to the technological side of that?
the technological side, in the sense that your brains, we're all going to be changed by the fact that there are robots. Let me give you an example, okay?
Yeah.
At University of California, San Diego, you know this story because you know the person involved, and it was on the cover of the Smithsonian magazine. In terms of education and robotics, there's a researcher there called Javier Mouvet, and who has a robot that he calls Ruby, And the ruby has face and eyes and so on, and it's used for preschool children. It's to enable them to learn. It's part of the educational array of tools. He discovered that when he first put this robot into the room, that the children just walked past it. They didn't care. They had no interest in it at all. And it took them a while to figure out that until they changed the mathematical algorithm that was controlling the eyebrows and the facial expressions of this little creature, that the children had no interest in it. As soon as they got the movements right, the speed right, and everything right, so that it was something that they could understand, something that they could compute from using human cognition, they absolutely fell in love with the thing. And they use it now as a teaching tool. So here's an example of brains being in-tuned with machinery, which then helps them to improve their cognition. So does that is that a little bit of a better lead-up for
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. That gives me a little more of an anchor to, to start off on. So, yes, absolutely. As we all know, technology can and continues to play a profound role in how we think, how we make decisions. In my own work, it really does resonate with the story we just heard, where I do work in robotics and artificial intelligence. And my group is called the Personal Robots Group, so you can imagine, you know, what our research agenda is about when we think about robots as a truly ubiquitous technology. And in many ways, I see the development of this field as paralleling the evolving development of the personal computer, where at first computers were developed for specialists, very few people knew how to use them. When you started posing the question, what happens when anyone can and should be able to use this technology, what are the implications for the interface? And so for robotics, I'm known for exploring the social, the emotional, and interpersonal aspects of how you design technologies so that they're natural to interact with, because it's like interacting with another person or perhaps a companion animal. It's really pulling in on the social aspects of this. I think what we found when we started doing this research, you know, if you really want to explore machines that can interact with people, and I mean the whole person in terms of, the social and emotional dimensions, which are certainly profound to being human, people and children in particular became our model. So developmental psychology became an important model for how we think about modeling these systems, since people are, of course, a key example of systems that already do this very well. And what we found is that robots became an intriguing technology, a new technology to do science, in the sense of, you can imagine in psychology, neuroscience, there's many, many, many theories. This technology would allow you to, in some sense, embody that theory in something that could interact with the world and interact with people. So it became an intriguing scientific tool to think about how we think about and understand ourselves. And then we could also start having these robots interact with people in rigorous scientific experiments to understand, again, the social loop of how people respond now to these technologies. What we're finding, which in some ways is surprising, in some ways not perhaps, is that if you design technologies to exhibit the same sorts of social cues that people naturally exhibit, things like eye contact, postural mirroring, inflections in voice, it pushes our social buttons to such an extent that we essentially treat these technologies in a very interpersonal sense, meaning that when you think about the role of nonverbal cues on the perception of trust or persuasiveness or liking or engagement, it turns out that you can vary these cues in a way to have people trust, be persuaded by, feel that they can trust a technology. So this is both, an opportunity and something that needs to be understood, because there's a side of caution there, I think, which is the exciting thing in the science is that we can start to understand through this use of technology a much more systematic sense of how people's social intelligence and our response to the embodied side impacts how we interact with one another. You can imagine technologies now where, instead of having a cell phone or having a face on a screen, in the future, might you be able to jack into a physical version of you, a robotic presence of you, to be able to actually physically be at a different location to interact. So for instance, at this meeting, I have three very young children at home. 5 years from now, I might seriously consider, would I rather jack into a robot to be able to shake hands and make eye contact and do all the roles and be here, but still actually be at home with my children. In the future, you might imagine if I'm on a construction zone in Japan and I'm a person in India, say, I can work that construction site, because through that robot I can do the physical and the social aspects What does that do to change the economy? I think there's a lot of potential here, but also is the consequences of this is what are the implications in terms of our ability to interact with those, and especially when you think about children and development, the application of these technologies, say learning technologies. There's many, many open questions in terms of the appropriate use of this technology that we're trying to understand, and I think it's also, of course, a point of this panel. So, of course, opportunities as well as things need to be understood to design the technology appropriately.
So, Nita, would you like to sort of comment on that, possibly the dark side of technologies as well, or the practical
applications? I don't want to be the naysayer at the Conference of Technology. I certainly think that these technologies are impressive technologies, and they do have the potential to transform society. My concerns are about the ways in which they change our concepts of self, the way in which they change our interactions with one another, and what these implications, what implications they may have. So, building on the types of technologies that we were just speaking about, there are some that are even more interactive with individuals. So there's some technologies for brain-machine interface that are being developed, and the idea of brain-machine interface is whether it's external to you as a robot or actually changing the brain by plugging things into the brain. So a wonderful application of this technology is for quadriplegics. So unable before to interact with the outside world, there's now technologies where you can actually put electrodes in their brain or implant something in their brain, and that allows them to communicate with the outside world. So they can navigate through a computer screen, they can move a wheelchair, they can function fully in society by having this technology implanted into their brain. I think that's wonderful. Now, of course, there is a natural end to some of these technologies. So the military in the United States is quite interested in the same technology because if we don't have to be present and we could have a robot be there in our place, are we going to have the robots fighting the war? And would we no longer have the types of human inhibitions that we might otherwise have in those types of interactions? So if you have a robot who's fighting a war who might not have your same reservations, or you've plugged into the brain to overcome your natural reservations that you might have to, say, killing civilians, for example. Or should we be concerned about that? Is it changing the nature of our attitudes, of what we think is moral and immoral? Are we changing who we are as people and losing our own self-identity by introducing this kind of technology? And, you know, I wouldn't say the answer is that we don't develop it. I think the answer is that we need to be reflective as we're developing it and have safeguards, have open conversations about it, understand what the technology is going to do and whether we want it to go to the ends that are being proposed.
Okay. Let me introduce Aubrey de Grey at this point. And let me just say, there's magazines out here, current magazines, the aging cure on this one. Can we cure aging on this one as well? Aging, obviously, in this context, being perceived as a disease. Is it a disease, Aubrey?
Well, this is a very important question because people's answer to it really depends not so much on their perception of what aging is, but rather on their perception of what a disease is. So it's really a matter of semantics whether we call aging a disease. But what we can say quite unequivocally is that aging is something that's bad for you and that it's something that happens to the body, and therefore it's a completely legitimate, in principle, target for medical intervention. Whether we actually call it a disease or not is somewhat irrelevant. The question then is, how soon are we going to be able to make it a practical target for medical intervention? By which I mean, of course, not simply the medicines that already exist today that can do, as we know, really only very little to postpone the ill health of old age, but rather interventions that can bring aging under control to the same sort of extent that we can already do for most infectious diseases, for example. That's essentially the focus of my work. I really want to come back to something that you said in your original introduction to me at the beginning, where you focused on longevity. You said, you know, I want to make people live a lot longer. I think it's very important for everyone here to be aware that that's really not what I work on. I work on keeping people healthy. And the only difference between the vision that I see for medical intervention against aging and the vision that already exists in the rest of the medical profession is that I think we're within striking distance of being able to combat aging well enough that, on average, people will live a lot longer simply as a side benefit, a side effect of being as healthy as they were in early adulthood, however long they live. And when I ask people whether they want to live a long time, I tend to get a wide range of answers. But when I ask people whether they want to get Alzheimer's disease or type 2 diabetes or cardiovascular disease or whatever, I tend to get a fairly uniform answer. So I think it's very important to emphasize that when people think about this, they have a tendency, especially, I have to say, people in the media, to sensationalize the thing and to essentially promote a degree of emotional distance from the question so that people can effectively not get their hopes up too much and can carry on treating it rather as entertainment and as science fiction. This is very damaging to the rate at which we will progress, because the sooner we actually get a sense of proportion about this and recognize that we do actually currently have a big problem, that must be weighed against any problems of changing in the structure of society that might result from the defeat of aging. The sooner we realize that, the more effort we will put into developing these diseases, these treatments, and the sooner we will have some success in alleviating the immense amount of suffering that is caused by age-related ill health today.
So one of the points you're making then, obviously, is that in writing a cover line for a magazine, somebody obviously keeps it short, keeps it pithy, and tries to sell magazines. So communication of science is one of the things that we have a problem with, in the sense that people seem to require certitude. They would like diseases to be eradicated. They would like solutions to various technological problems. That's not how science works, unfortunately. It's more
right. I'm not really putting all the blame on the media here. I think that the media, have a job to do, to sell magazines, to get people on the viewing their programs, for example. And so really, it's beholden on people like myself, people who work in this area, to go out and help people to understand both the scientific progress that's likely to occur and that could occur, and also the social context of all of that, the consequences for society, the consequences in terms of ethics and economics and so on. And this is something that has to be done sort of hand in hand with the media. It's very important, I think, for all scientists who work in anything that's of social relevance, especially of biomedical relevance, to take their courage in their hands, even if they're not trained to do it, and to really work with the media to help to educate society, rather than being just scared of getting on in front of a television camera.
Okay. Maria, let's turn to you for a moment. You're in an organization that deals at the sharp end with this in terms of looking for projects that are worth rewarding, research projects that are worth rewarding. We've talked somewhat about global health issues and so on. We talked about the aging issue with Liz Blackburn's work on telomeres. Given what Ambassador Bokova said this morning, how do you see your organization channeling its efforts in the future?
Well, let's start, I guess, by putting in context what the Lasker Foundation does. And we, one of the things we do, and one of the most important things we do, is give what is known as the Lasker Awards. And we have a very good record of choosing the right people to get the awards, I'm very proud to say. But why do we give awards? Why does science require to give awards? I suppose we give awards for three reasons. We give awards because we think that the work is remarkable and we ought to highlight a field of work or a field of study. We give awards because we think an individual that has done that work is particularly important or particularly critical. But we also give awards, to Audrey's point, because it's a hook for the media. And the media like champions, and the media like to be able to say they won the Lasker or they won the Nobel, or X number of Lasker winners have won the Nobel, etc. So it's a symbiosis between the understanding of the importance of science, and in particular in our case of basic science, and the importance to educate people. So I want to give you an example of this year's awards, if I may, and how they illustrate this point. So we have a fantastic jury. We have 25 members of our jury that select these awards. And what they chose to award this year was we have a basic science award, a clinical award, and this year we had a public service award. And what struck me was that this year we illustrated sort of the continuum of how science can influence society. So The basic award we gave to John Gurdon and Shimya Yamanaka because they figured out how the cell, a cell from your skin or from your muscle, can be reprogrammed to be embryonic. We gave, so we don't have to use embryos, we can use those cells. We gave an award for clinical research for people who discovered how to attack cancer for myeloid leukemia. And we gave an award to the mayor of New York City because he used science to base some of his policies. So he banned smoking from public places in New York City. He banned the use of trans fat in cooking for people in New York. And he put a very aggressive campaign against guns. So you see, he used science that was developed many years before to understand the impact of tobacco, to understand the impact of trans fats, and I think guns are pretty obvious. So you start from the very basic research, goes into clinical application, and then it goes into public policy. And I think it's that interaction and that link that's a very important link for the North and for the South.
Juan, we should hear from you. You tell us about the application of some of the, how you go about applying some of the basic research in economic fields, I mean, genomics and so on and so forth.
So I used to be an academic, and then I crossed into the dark side and went into venture capital. And in the process of that, what I really would like you to take away is a single idea from what I have to say. If I'd been sitting here in the 1970s and I'd told you that most of the wealth in the world and most of your children's wealth and most of your country's wealth is going to depend on the ability to understand ones and zeros, you probably would have thought that I was absolutely crazy. But let me explain why that was important, because not only did you collapse every word written and spoken in English into two letters instead of 26, you also collapsed every photograph, every bit of music, every video, every film into two letters. And most of the wealth generated over the last 30 years and most of the rise of countries or the disappearance of countries, and by the way, 3/4 of the flags at the UN were not there 60 years ago, has occurred in places where they speak ones and zeros. Here's the idea I want to leave you with. The biggest single driver of the global economy going forward is going to be the ability to read and write life code. And it's going to change energy and pharmaceuticals and textiles and fashion and computing, and it's going to mean the rise and fall of countries. And it's incredibly important when you talk about education that it not just be done in platitudes, but that you understand that what's driving the growth in Exxon, in Mobil, in General Electric, in biotechs, in areas of the country that are growing quickly, is the ability to understand areas like Cynthia's in robotics, to understand neuroscience, and particularly to understand life code. Because you're going to see some very large changes over the next decade that have to do with reading and writing life code, and it's going to be as important as the Industrial Revolution, as a digital revolution, and now you've got a life science revolution.
So when we have that situation, which we have a dichotomy there between, we spoke about this morning, between transparency and intrusiveness, lack of privacy, and so on. Would you like to speak to that?
I mean, look, the research that Maria was just talking about, where you can take a skin cell and turn it into an undifferentiated stem cell, and then grow a full mouse out of that, has a couple of implications. The first is all men have now become obsolete,
right,
which may or may not be a bad thing.
Not women, though.
Absolutely not women. The second thing it means is, you know, if somebody can take cells from the glass that you have in front of you and reprogram them to make a body part, and we're already able to regrow tracheas, or we're able to regrow stomachs, or we're able to regrow retinas, we're entering a period where our concept of privacy, our concept of ownership, who owns my gene code, what are you going to do with it, how are you going to structure it, becomes much harder to control. And there's going to be three converging technologies in this. One is they can take your actual cells and do it. The second is they can take your gene code and use that gene code to build something basically off of your code. And the third is our concept of even who's handicapped and what a body part is going to change in a fundamental way. When you think about the research that Cynthia's doing and how important it is, a person who was handicapped used to be your grandfather who had a great big cone to listen to the family conversation. Your father had a hearing aid that would squawk at very odd times during dinner. If you have a hearing aid today, you don't notice it. But with cochlear implants, what you're beginning to see is people who are deaf who can hear in a room like this. And every 18 months, their power to hear doubles and yours does not. And very quickly, we're going to get human beings who can hear in tonal scales that we can't, who can focus their hearing, who can turn it up, turn it down. And it's conceivable in 10 years that you will not be hired by a symphony orchestra unless if you were handicapped and were deaf. And that's a very different world. It's a world of very different technologies coming together. It's going to be really important. Hang on for this ride and particularly understand it, because otherwise you're not going to be able to be in the social debates and the ethical debates that you were talking about.
Would either of you, any of you like to respond to that, and then we'll come to Pat? Or do you want to respond to that, Pat?
Well, I'm not sure how best to respond to that, except that I totally agree with what you say, and that often we want a fast way of understanding certain aspects of biology, but it isn't really simple stuff. Sometimes the basic outline can be simple, but to really grasp it requires a huge effort. And so we have to find ways maybe of doing a better job in teaching. I have another thought, but it's sort of a dark thought, so maybe I'll come back to that later. You know, it's sort of a dark thought to complement Aubrey's optimism, which I think is totally wonderful, and I share. Let me just express the dark thought, then we'll suppress it and carry on.
Dark thoughts can come before lunch.
The dark thought is this: that we all, of course, understand that there are enormous population pressures, and that certain kinds of tensions arise on the planet now because of population pressures. And if we can not only live a little bit longer by taking care of ourselves and taking lots of vitamins and calcium, but we can live a lot longer, then there is a concern of two kinds. One is that the population pressures are going to be magnified. There's just too damn many of us. The other thing, and this is certainly something that my cohort talks a lot about, and that is, and I'm especially interested in this right now because I just came from Switzerland where we talked a lot about Dignitas. There should be an acceptable, dignified, respectable way of saying, I'm done, and leaving. And it's very difficult, even, for example, in the UK, to get an assisted suicide bill passed. And I'm sorry to have to say that in the UK, it was stopped in the House of Lords because the bishops, like they would know, the bishops got together and voted en masse against it and made it very difficult for any others who were in the House of Lords to vote for it. So that's going to continue to be an issue, and the sooner we sort of come to grips with it in a good way, I think the better.
Okay, is it working yet? Okay. I'd really better say a couple of words in response to that. So first of all, with regard to the dignified death aspect. I 100% agree with you that we need a much more enlightened attitude worldwide on this matter at the moment. However, I do want to come back on the idea that it in any way relates to the sort of work that I'm doing to postpone age-related ill health, because it's very important to appreciate that when someone is extremely unwell and they've decided that they'd like a dignified way out, that's a very different question from when someone is completely healthy and they want a dignified way out. When people are in that state, we have a word for it. We call it suicidal, and we try to help them. We think they've got a problem that they would actually like to know about, like to be cured of, so to speak. Now, I think that that is a function not of their chronological age, but of their biological age, and that if people at the age of 100 or even older were in a biological state equivalent in terms of health, in terms of how they look, how they feel, how they function to young adults today, and they feel that it's time to go, then we'll probably have, and I think we should have, the same attitude to that as we have to people who are chronologically 30 or whatever. And in other words, try to help them out of that state and see what opportunities life has for them. When it comes to overpopulation, I think this is a very important thing to address, because even though I myself am a scientist rather than a sociologist or anything, nevertheless I feel, as I was saying in my earlier response to Roger, that those of us who work in this area have a duty to get engaged on the social context matters. There are a lot of very complicated questions here with regard to what's actually going to happen, a lot of uncertainties. One thing that absolutely has not yet been adequately looked at by demographers, by sociologists, by anyone really, is the possibility that when menopause becomes optional, so to speak, and becomes reversible, so that women are able to have children safely at whatever age they like, there may actually be a sharp decline in the birth rate as a result of an extension of the phenomenon we're already seeing, where women in any nation, any society where they get good education and enlightenment and emancipation are delaying the birth of their first child. That turns out mathematically to be by far more important for demographic change than the overall total number of children that a woman has over their lives. And of course, some of you may be thinking that it doesn't sound like very much fun to be carrying on having periods every month until you're 384, but as I say, it's not something that would necessarily be continuous. That's just one aspect. I mean, that's one of half a dozen different things that one needs to look at if one wants to actually predict what's going to happen in terms of population trajectories as we continue to postpone the ill health of old age. However, we really can also effectively short-circuit all of that from a moral point of view by simply saying, well, look, should we be imposing our assumptions, our values on humanity of the future in order to determine whether we should develop these therapies? Or should we, in fact, be saying, well, okay, there may or may not be these social challenges that will come up if we really have great success, but it should be humanity of the future that decides how to address those challenges, whether to use these technologies, whether to just not use them, whether to use them and compensate in some way. So, and if we take all of that in the context of the rather easily forgotten point that we currently already have a problem, we have 100,000 people a day dying of age-related ill health one way or another. In the Western world, of course, it's something like 90% of all deaths. You know, then it becomes rather easier to come to a decision as to what we should actually do, even though one obviously must remain conscious of all these potential challenges that would result.
So let me just ask a question. How many of you actually have any kind of a scientific background? Could you just raise your hands if you have any science background? So it's not as bad as I feared, but still limited. How many of you think, as Ambassador Bukova said, that science is a hugely important aspect of the world that we're now creating? All right, so there's many more hands there. And what are let me come and ask you some questions. What are the things that keep you awake at night? What are the things that worry you? Does anybody have something they want to talk about that was stimulated perhaps by this panel? I'm lurching towards you. Are you thinking? Do you have any ideas? All right, over here. Great. Thank you.
Coming back to research, biology, there's one point you raised regarding stem cells, regeneration, etc. But how comes so few people are questioning the fact that some animals are regenerating members, for example, not mammals, but batracians? I don't know whether in English this is the correct word. Or, for example, when you do surgery on a fetus, When the baby comes out afterwards, he has no scar. So this is basically something which should be more recognized, more investigated. We have in the body, when you have a wound, then the information for wound healing comes at the end. After a very short period of time, it cannot express itself properly unless you help it. And this is something which I guess should be more addressed, much more addressed, and that could be maybe not eradicate, but reduce the debate on stem cells, because this is all what I wanted to say.
Yeah, so I can...
Aubrey?
I can give you some very good news. This is indeed a very important area of regenerative medicine, something that is being looked at a great deal, and there is great progress being made in this area. One thing that's a widespread misconception with regard to scarring and other failures of regeneration and of wound healing and so on in higher mammals such as humans is it's not that we have lost genetic pathways that allow this to happen. As you say, we see these pathways active in the fetus, for example. What has happened is that we've gained systems that actively suppress regeneration. And there is a widespread belief, which I share, that the reason we have done this is because from the point of view of overall fitness and health and evolutionary advantage, one of the things we need to avoid is cancer. Now, cancer, of course, is the result of uncontrolled cell division. It happens as a result of mutations. Mutations happen when cells divide. So there is a trade-off between how well you repair an injury and how much risk you impose on yourself of getting cancer as a result. It's therefore likely that in order to make a decisive amount of progress in restoring the regenerative capacity that we see in lower vertebrates and also in very young mammals, we will need to do this in combination with a very decisive assault on cancer, more decisive than we have yet available.
Yes. To come back to your question, Roger, what makes me not sleep at night is the misuse of science for business logic, the misuse of all this creativity and scientific innovation. I gave my stem cell for storage because I gave birth, and it doesn't make me sleep well.
So what do you mean by misuse of science?
The ethical use of science. We don't know whether we will evolve and we will have regulations and ethical enough so that all these evolution go and remain humane.
So, Nita, would you like to speak to that, and Pat, possibly?
Yes. So, that also makes me not sleep that well at night, as a lot of this technology is being developed without regulation, without discussion. To go back to some of the genomic kind of technology, there are all sorts of organizations out there right now that will allow you to send a swab from your mouth of saliva in so that you can have your complete genome sequenced. And there's this move toward the $100 genome so that you can do this quickly and with very little cost. And that information, once it's out there, can be used for lots of different purposes, right? So to Juan's point, there's a lot that we can do with that. We can build new organisms. We can build you. We can find out a lot of information about you. The more we know about genomes, the more, once that information is out in the public domain, we can start to understand about you as a person, and more invasive and intrusive the information becomes. So, to the idea of waiting for future generations to decide how they're going to use the technology is problematic, because it may be used on them before they have a choice. So if we're doing genomic interventions or if we're doing neurological interventions, that changes and shapes our future generations. And that may actually be used on them before they have a choice. If we have technologies like brain-machine interface, or if we have cognitive enhancers or other types of drugs, it may become such the norm that by the time the future generation arrives, they have to use the technology if they wish to remain competitive. So I think we need to actually keep the dialogue, whether it's with the scientist getting involved in it, in conjunction with other people, with ethicists, and to try to stay ahead of it rather than constantly catching up with regulation.
If I can just add to that, I mean, I guess I think that there are many regulations in many countries that are in place, and they're by and large very effective. But one of the things that I think I really worry about, and this gets back to Jose's point, is that often there is so much misunderstanding out there. I mean, just sheer ignorance about such things as genetically modified food, otherwise known as Frankenfood, that I think scientists are trying very hard to sort of bring people up to speed, but there often is a completely irrational response. And it's sometimes very difficult, I think, to know how to deal with it. And if indeed it's all about science, 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 then we really need to get ourselves in the picture.
And I just want to add one other aspect. I think of the conversation that's coming up implicitly is on the other side of science that's also critical is engineering. And we have to ask ourselves not only what kind of science we're doing, but who's doing it, what kind of engineering we're doing, but who's doing it. And certainly when you talk about the application of science, women are very underrepresented in engineering fields, so I hope that people get the E for engineering to couple with the science. I think this is a critical thing, and I think when we think about the education of our children and what an engineer should be and should what skills they should have, it needs to be a much broader discussion to address, I think, ethics and these other social consequences. So even our definition of what engineering is shouldn't be so narrow, I think, as it is defined today. But I think our future engineers, the way we educate our children in these fields, needs to be much broader, much more appreciative of all of these consequences, because science and technology is changing so fast, so fast. We need to be able to have this dialogue so we can make informed decisions on how to design for these applications.
Well, Roger, I just don't want to leave the group thinking that, you know, scientists are totally oblivious, that there's a very important ethical component to it. And so, you know, there's plenty of discourse going, and I think the examples of people here that weigh the pros and cons. So I wouldn't lose all that much sleep, but I would be very vigilant, and I would be part of the conversation. And I think that's why it's important for society to understand science, so you can be part of the conversation.
Well, it seems to me that all the dialogue is really going in one direction, that we can achieve the long life, which is that probably, as Professor de Grey said, probably 385, and it is as if we are jump-starting and preparing the our societies proactively for the fact that we're going to get there. And it seems to me that all of this is ongoing on the assumption that our environment is not going to actually move around us. We are trying to change things, and on the assumption that our environment is not going to actually react. We have an example of cancer and bacteria, whereby we have resistance that is building up to antibiotics. We have mutations that are taking place in the environment, and this is continuously changing. So in this regard, I would like to pose the question, how sure are you that while we're causing these changes, we're not going to actually have other major changes that might threaten humanity? This is on one hand. On the other hand, I'm really concerned about the psychology of the future generations. We're almost not talking to each other. We send each other emails while we're sitting on the same table sometimes. So where are our skills going? What are we heading into? And what is the future of our societies? Thank you.
These are extremely important questions.
And they both incidentally came from the PricewaterhouseCoopers table, which is obviously doing accountancy on our future.
Yeah. So with respect to the first question about other challenges to humanity, I think there are two ways to look at this. Certainly, we must look today at making sure that we do not lose sight of any of the major challenges that we have in favor of the other challenges we have. I think perhaps today, I would argue that we have more visibility and more attention being paid to some challenges, such as, for example, climate change, than we do to the problem of age-related ill health, which we are in some way sleepwalking into believing we can't change. But I think there's a much more optimistic way of looking at this as well, which is that as we make more progress in combating certain of the biggest problems, such as the problem of age-related ill health, we will raise our sights. Humanity in general, both men and women, will become empowered to feel more capable of combating the other big problems that we have. I certainly feel that if humanity were able to essentially defeat its oldest foe, namely the problem of age-related ill health and death, then we would certainly be a very different society in terms of our ambition, our ability to think big and to have a good go at really combating climate change, really trying to achieve world peace, you know, those sorts of things. And so your point is very well taken, but I have, again, a rather optimistic take on what the impact of the sorts of technology that combat aging will actually have on it.
Juan, you look posed.
Let me give you a practical example of stuff I was talking about, I think in the context you're asking about. We put together a really strange-sounding company about 3 years ago, and we brought in a guy who won the Nobel Prize for splitting genes and the guy who sequenced the human genome, and we asked if we could reprogram a cell from scratch. And that means you take the DNA out of the cell, you insert new DNA, and that cell becomes a completely different species. Then we asked ourselves if we can program cells as you program computers, because cells become hardware. Can you build a very long stretch of DNA so that you can write a software program so it would execute, say, a PowerPoint or a Word or a Excel spreadsheet, except it would do so in the form of life code? And we published the largest organic molecule humans have ever built last January. When you bring these two things together, they sound really exotic, except our first large customer is Exxon to make fuels from algae, and they're putting $600 million into that. And as you start facing these issues of how do you take sunlight and CO2 to make fuels, the types of questions and the scale of the problems that we're beginning to generate are going to require solutions that have conservation, that have wind power, that have solar power. But we're also going to require starting to treat hydrocarbons as sunlight concentrated in organic matter. And if we start to do that, then some of the questions you're asking, I think, are going to start to be addressed. But we've got to start running really fast on this stuff, because we're running out of time.
The other thing that comes out of that, of course, is that you have to think about how across global and between cultures these things are going to operate. It's 1968 that Garrett Hardin wrote The Tragedy of the Commons. That issue is still with us. How is the distributive justice to work in there? But that's something we've talked on a little bit this morning. You have a...
Yes, I'm Una Ryan, and I'm not concerned at all about most of the things that you're doing, but I have a different concern. And that is, when you have the problem, it's very obvious to the public, it's self-evident that we need solutions. And I think that the biggest enemy we have is actually success. And the example I'd give is, I'm now in the algae business, but I used to be in the vaccine business. And I think vaccines were so successful that we no longer have, you know, childhood pneumonias, mumps, measles, chickenpox, all those things. And people have forgotten the threat about them. And so their biggest concerns are about the very few side effects that they see in vaccines. And they've forgotten what they're being protected against. So I'm concerned that you may be so successful with some of these new technologies, people won't believe they're needed, and they'll fret about safety issues.
Thank you. And there's another one question here just before I leave this area.
Could you stand up? Yes. Hi, my name is Antonia. I'm from Bulgaria. And it happens almost often, quite very often at home, that we have this discussion about where is the future going. And my stepfather often says that very soon there will be no gas and we need to go back to the farm. And we try to laugh, but the populations are growing every day. And as we know, from 6 billion, maybe in 10 years will be 8, and then in 10 more, what, 15? And then we see all this discussion about helping people, and I'm all about it. But my main concern is how would the Earth take all of us? And if we have robots to replace us at certain locations, how are we gonna, the numbers will grow even more exponentially. And my concern is, what would happen then? How are we gonna deal with this success on one hand and with this huge failure that the Earth is not endless? We have not endless resources. Thank you.
So you solved that one in 3 minutes.
I am not going to solve that one, but I want to respond to the previous question and this one together to say that I think one thing that's important for us to recognize that's coming out of a lot of these comments is that technology is incremental, and how we accept that technology and the way it changes society happens incrementally, and we may forget about the bigger picture along the way when we are focusing on just the individual technology, or in retrospect, we may have lost that view. So to take an example that we have from modern day, right? Our concepts of privacy have changed dramatically just in the past generation. So before there was email, people communicated via letters. Those letters you wouldn't expect necessarily could travel around the globe instantly. Then we had emails. That information travels around the globe instantly. People don't expect to have privacy in their emails. Now we have Facebook. People post information that many of us wouldn't, but the younger generation, and the younger you are, the more likely you are to put pictures up about yourself and information up about yourself. And each one of these technologies, as they're introduced, change our conception of privacy, change and shift our norms about what we expect from society and what we accept in society. So if we wait until we just have all of the technology such that we can live forever and let future generations deal with it, we'll miss the opportunity along the way to have these important conversations, because each new technology has an incremental effect on society and our expectations.
Yeah, I do want to absolutely back that up. I think that's completely correct. And one of the most difficult things to do, even for specialists in a particular area of technology, is to anticipate the ways in which other technologies will be changing simultaneously and in parallel, and the impact that that will have on how the technology that they particularly work on is going to evolve and indeed be disseminated and taken up. I think in general, the whole idea of that I was putting forward of saying that future generations are entitled to make choices for themselves should not be overgeneralized. I'm absolutely not disagreeing with what you're saying, Nita, about the dangers of, in some ways, perhaps denying people choice by making choices before they have the chance to make them themselves. However, I do think that argument itself can be taken too far, and one needs a happy medium in which the technological opportunities are developed so that the maximum amount of choice can be made available to future generations.
Masa Mufti from Damascus, Syria. Going back to the first question, which is what makes us worry, really. If we go back to the philosophical question, why human beings live here on Earth, and environmentally speaking, I think there's a big conflict between the human urge to achieve more and to live longer and the human urge to engender children. And if we face the problems that we have, is that we have a highest rate of infertility despite the breakthrough of science in IVF and everything. I sometimes worry at night before going to sleep if I wonder if my children will have the chance to be parents. And looking around us, how many people are now unable to have children, which is a human urge. So I'd rather actually live a decent life, but procure or be in, or ensure that there is a chance for my children to be parents as well. So I don't know if we can address this, but this is really a serious issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pat, do you want to have a word at that? You did that earlier.
All right, I'll do this again.
I'm making my way to a forest of hands here. Let me just do this first. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Ridora. I'm from the Philippines, but I live in Singapore. This is an important discussion because I think it's an opportunity to frame the future, both for all human beings and human society. My question is related to my father, 79, and who really wouldn't want to live to be 150, because he says, I would have no friends by then. So my question to the panel would be, the implications of living a longer life. This is a debate about prolonging life versus deepening meaning, and I think we need to keep the balance. What will be your personal advice to human beings in the future who, by this discussion, we will be creating, human beings in the future who live longer, live healthier, about what they will do with a longer life, having experienced yourself what it's like to be living at your age?
Yeah. Okay. So
I just want to say one thing, and then I have to go and catch a plane. I personally find it really hard to think about what the future is going to be like given the current state of technology. I was one of the first adopters of the internet when it was part of the Defense Department ARPANET, and it was the way that academics would communicate with one another. And if you had asked me then about the implications of the internet, and I suppose to a degree we did chat about this, I had no idea. I mean, nah. I also knew Francis Crick very well, and we talked about the development of molecular biology and the absolutely staggering things that could be done with genetic engineering and the use of DNA fingerprinting and so forth. And I asked him, I said, well, did you see, even, say, 1960, the discovery was 1954, did you see where this was going? Now, he's way smarter than I am. He said he had no idea. He said, I thought it was big, but I had no idea what was going to actually happen. Now, of course, it's fun to speculate. The worry is, of course, we get all gloomy and doomy, and we say, well, we got to have regulations, and we're all going to hell in a handbasket, and our kids don't know how to socialize anymore. But people have always said that. I remember my parents saying, these young people are all going to hell in a handbasket. And we were, and here we are. So I don't mean to introduce a note of levity where it doesn't really belong. Of course, these are all very serious issues and so forth. But let's not take the prognostications of where a future technology is going to take us as though we know.
Yeah,
Actually, Pat.
So thank you, Pat. Patricia,
before you leave, Hillary had a question for you.
Yeah, Hillary Bowker. You mentioned dark side dignity to death. What about what happens when you have a whole bunch of old people around? They're using up most of the resources, taking up all the jobs. What do the young people do?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And especially if it's the case that the old people are quite happy to exit. And I've known lots of old people who didn't feel that they needed to wait until, you know, the heart finally gave out and so forth. But they were in lots of pain from arthritis and this and that and were quite happy to exit. And having visited Dignitas in Switzerland and realizing the kind of regulations you can have in place, interestingly, one of which is that no physician is directly involved. I thought that was amazingly interesting.
Pat, sorry to cut you off. I'm not talking about people who are ready to die. I'm talking about people who get old, who are perfectly happy being there and not willing to kind of give way.
Right. Okay. So in the U.S. and probably elsewhere, it's been considered age discrimination to make people retire at 65. I'm trying to make a sort of mild statement along those lines. I'm retiring. But I do have colleagues who are sort of staggering around in their 70s and their 75s.
not very good teachers, doing no research, pulling in a big salary, while waiting in the wings are young scientists who are terrific and willing to get on with it. So I think that the lifting of that that age barrier for retirement is very, very mixed. But I'm happy to say I'm going kayaking and doing all the things, skiing again, and doing all the things I really want to do.
All right, so I have been told that on that note, we've reached the end of the conversation. We've run out of time.
Roger, can I just have 1 minute to give a
very brief out of time, but it's not going to work, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah. Okay. So, first of all, I think it's right.
First of all, the other moderator takes over the show, and now you want to take over the show. I mean...
So, in response to a couple of the things that have been said, I actually would refer you to a wonderful essay. If you Google the word transsimianism, then you will find a wonderfully humorous essay about how we're all going to hell in a handbasket if we do anything about the new future technology. What are we going to do with all these geriatric 27-year-olds around? This was, of course, written in supposed to be written in Neanderthal times. I think we've coped quite well so far with extension of life expectancy, and there's really no... justification in the belief that we would not be able to restructure society accordingly as we get life expectancy even longer. In general, I think, you know, reactions like, oh dear, I wouldn't have any friends around, are a fine example of the spectacular, breathtaking desperation to turn one's brain off that happens when this sort of subject comes up. I mean, how likely is it that any one particular person, such as the person you're talking to, would be the only person of his generation, his or her generation, to actually benefit from these therapies? If he's going to be around, then so are people of his cohort. So it's completely unbelievable that anyone would be so embarrassingly illogical as to actually think that that's a justification for not developing these therapies and saving people from the age-related suffering that we see today.
So I think you can continue the conversation at lunchtime, perhaps go and pounce on Aubrey and give him some thoughts. It's been a wonderful panel. Thank you very much, panelists. Thank you all for being here. And let me just say that having been here for 4 days now, I've had a wonderful time. This has been a great meeting. And I think that the people who are responsible for putting on should be given a round of applause, including Jennifer Milliken over there. So thank you very much.